welcome to this episode of 10,000 Posts, the show about how everything is posting. My name is Hussein, and this week I am joined by the writer and editor, Merritt Kay. Merritt's got a book out at the moment. It's actually, there's a collection of essays, vignettes, and also photographs of LAN parties. And the book is, the book is called LAN Party, the Inside the Multiplayer Revolution. I just wanted to make sure I got that right, so apologies for the hesitance. It's a really, really beautiful book. Merritt sent it to us the other day, like last week, and I was reading it like on my screen, and it looks really beautiful in here, but I can only imagine like how wonderful it looks like in print. All of which is to say, Merritt, number one, well done for writing this book, and well done for like putting it together, but also welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Yeah, thank you. And thanks for having me back. I'm doing well. When was the last time I was on?
A while ago. I was trying to remember what it was, but I do remember it was a time when we talked about other Merritts, because there was some beef between Merritts.
Oh, God, yes.
And I was trying to figure out what was the beef between the Merritts. I don't know. It was something to do with leftism. It had something to do with like communism.
I think it was a beef. I think it was just that someone had confused me with someone else whose name was very similar to mine.
Okay.
It was a whole thing. And it was one of those situations where like it was kind of like a lesser version of the Naomi Klein, Wolf thing, where I was getting a lot of like mentions like, you're terrible, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, what are you talking about? That was ages ago.
It was ages ago. But there was beef between Merritts at some point. I don't know whether it was when you came on, but I do remember there was beef between the Merritts that had something to do with communism. I'm not sure what. That's the extent of my brain poison. I'm sure one of the other listeners on this show will remember and remind me. All of which is to say, Merritt, welcome back. I invited you on because I want to talk about this book that has just come out that you were promoting. It's called LAN Party, and it's about LAN parties, to put it in very succinct terms. It seems to be like a collection of essays and vignettes about people who sort of grew up in the 90s and the 2000s in a very specific period of time that you mention in the book, and other writers mentioned the book as well, when the LAN party was kind of like an epicenter of like socializing within the context of, or like incorporating the context of technology. So in a lot of these photos, you have people who are like sitting in rooms, sitting in groups, and they were like, you know, on tables surrounded by these very big computers that are all sort of connected to each other. And the photos are really interesting just because obviously like these are, you know, it's sort of like a time shot in history that for me anyway, and I'm, you know, you and I are probably like seemingly of similar generations. You know, we're aware of as possibly like our first interactions with being like experiencing the internet on a social level. I guess like as a starting point, you know, number one, were you ever part of any, like, did you ever sort of participate in LAN parties at all? But also what drove you to sort of like want to do this book? Because it is such an interesting study about like of internet history that I don't think I've really seen anywhere else.
So when I was a kid, we would hang out and people would be playing games sometimes. And I never had like a real gaming PC that wasn't sort of a thing in my household. We had a Dell. And if I had asked my parents, can I bring our family computer over to a friend's house? They would have looked at me like I was crazy. Like, that's what we do our taxes on. What are you talking about? Mm. So I never brought my computer to places, but I would go over to friends' houses and they would be doing stuff like this. And I think what inspired me to want to do this was, it was back in like 2021. And so obviously COVID is still with us, but it was sort of much newer at the time, and a lot more people were, I think, isolating. There was less access to vaccines. And there is the sense, like, I forget how I started looking at these photos again, just searching online, but this feeling of like, wow, that was really cool. Like, it feels like something that doesn't actually happen that much anymore. And certainly it didn't happen in 2021 because people weren't exactly looking to have these big in-person gatherings at the time. Mm. But I just got to thinking about how this was such a strange little period of time that really didn't last very long. And even though it wasn't that long ago, feels completely different from how we relate to technology and to games and things like that today. Mm. And I just posted something about wanting a book that was just full of these photos, and it got a huge response, like far bigger than I was expecting. And I just thought, you know what? Clearly other people want this too, and selfishly I want this book to exist. So what if I just did the work of taking it to a publisher and asking them if they were interested, because clearly there is this kind of groundswell of support for the idea. So I took it to Tamsin Hudson and they bit, and it went from there. And it's sort of, so it's been kind of a long time in the making. People might not think it would take that long to put together a book like this, but there's a lot of logistical work involved in trying to get all these photos together.
Yeah. In terms of like, so obviously like on an audio medium, like it is not the most ideal situation to try to describe like something that is inherently very visual. So number one, like subscribe to like, or at least follow our Instagram page, because we'll like see if we can put some photos up on there. Just as sort of like a general kind of to try, try capture this. But if you were to sort of like try and describe what a LAN party is, in the context of like, you know, bearing in mind that the photos sort of show different ways in which one could do it, but how would you sort of describe what a LAN party actually looks like?
Yeah. So the basic idea is you are bringing a bunch of computers to the same space and physically networking them with network cables and like switches and having a direct connection between the computers. So it's in the same way that like, I was about to make a reference to like a computer lab, and I'm not sure if that even is a good reference anymore. Like I remember back in school, we'd go to the computer lab and the computers would all be networked, so you could like share files and do things like that. And I don't think that's a thing that probably even happens anymore. You probably just have laptops in school. But the idea is basically you have like a high speed or faster than at the time internet connection to the other people in the room, which meant that you could play games which with much lower latency. So if you're playing like Quake or Doom or something, if you're playing that over a network connection, especially at the time, you don't really have the quality infrastructure that we have today, where you can have pretty low ping and have pretty instantaneous connections between people in various parts of the world. So if you wanted to have a good experience with those games, that was really the best way to do it, was to be in the same room and be physically connected with cables, not going through an internet connection, just directly networking to each other. So it involved just doing that, but also it wasn't just people playing games. It was, you know, people doing early file sharing, swapping games, swapping music, swapping porn probably, and also people just kind of hanging out in the same space.
Yeah. And I think this is like one of the things that I got when I was looking through the photos of the book, which is, and I think, and you mentioned this in your introduction, but also in like some of the other essays as well, which is that this is actually like, if we think about like the period of like LAN in terms of it being like a social phenomena, you can probably chart it to like maybe the late 90s to about the mid 2000s. So this is sort of a time when like the internet is sort of becoming more available, like readily available and sort of accepted in people's homes. Like, you know, at this point where, you know, you have like the family computer at the very least, but there isn't really like any type of way to, like, you know, there isn't really any type of way to kind of like socialize within the context of the internet that isn't maybe like a bulletin board or something. And so what's interesting about looking through these photos is that what you're sort of seeing is like an internet that is very grounded in the real world. And I think that's actually what, you know, and we can talk about this like throughout, like maybe like in various instances throughout the episode. But when I think about it in like the context of it being a social phenomena where, you know, at present, it's very, you know, one of the sort of like conversations, or at least sort of one of the anxieties that we have is that, you know, there is a, that there is like an endemic of loneliness because too many people are kind of warped into their, like their laptops or their phones or whatever, their social life exists online. This almost sort of feels like an inverse of that, where it's like, you know, people are kind of, you know, they are still sort of physically present with each other, and the computers are kind of like just sort of an additional medium within that. Like it's still very grounded in the real world. And so it's interesting, I think, maybe to look back on that. And I wondered whether, like, you know, looking back on that period of time, but also having putting together these essays, I wondered whether what the sense you got from other writers in terms of, or other contributors, like how did they sort of feel about this period? And is it kind of, is there like sort of like a melancholy as a result of like where we are right now in terms of internet culture and sort of looking back to when perhaps it was like a lot more of a social experience?
Yeah, I think there absolutely is that kind of feeling of melancholy around these photos and this time for a lot of people who were there. There, I think, is the sense that something was kind of lost. And even though, I talk about in the book, the LAN parties and the culture around games at the time were far from perfect. So one thing I think that's pretty obvious if you look through the photos is that most of the people in these pictures and most of the people at LAN parties, at least in the US, were white boys, right? And so there is that kind of aspect to it where this was a pretty male-dominated culture, a pretty white culture. And I think to some extent that is due to class reasons and due to people who could afford to have this stuff. But at the same time, you know, you talk about, yeah, we're all kind of isolated and on our phones and in our rooms and our computers. And I think there is this sense among a lot of people around my age that we're starting to see like the trade-off between like convenience and like the cost to us is tipping in a different direction. Like I think for a long time, you know, we grew up with the internet and with access to technology in ways that our parents had no idea about. And for a long time, we were the ones who were defending it and saying, no, this stuff is great. Look, I'm talking to people from all around the world. Mm-hmm. It's not dangerous. There's all these cool things I'm learning. There's all this amazing stuff I'm doing. And then we're getting to a point in our lives where so much of that old stuff has fallen away and it's been replaced by this corporate centralized, garbage that just wants to get your eyeballs and desperately wants your attention and has increasingly sophisticated ways of stealing your attention. And we're realizing like, oh, this now maybe we want to step back a little bit from this. And so that's one reason why I think looking at these pictures, people think, wow, that was actually a much healthier relationship to technology. And instead of being absorbed by it, it was facilitating relationships between people in a way that social media today really doesn't anymore.
Yeah.
It may once have, but at this point, it feels much more like for its own sake than for actually communicating. And so to look at pictures of people goofing around with computers and having fun is like, wow, that seems really utopian in a way. And also, I think younger people, you know, in their teens or early 20s who look at this stuff, a lot of them have said like, oh, I wish I was there. Like, I wish I had been born earlier. And in one sense, that is a very funny sentiment for me to hear because you know, it was just normal growing up at the time.
Yeah.
But I get it too, because they've grown up with the increasingly toxic, commodified version of the internet that they're realizing is not great for them. And this idea of a much more balanced and personal relationship to that stuff, I think is really appealing to a lot of people.
There's something also about control, I guess.
Absolutely.
I was just sort of thinking about this too, where it was this kind of, you know, part of it is sort of driven, again, looking through these photos, it's like the sort of ways in which, one of the, I don't know whether like how the sort of photos were put together, but one of the things that I kind of found was that if you sort of progress through the photos, you sort of go from these very sort of big, blocky, like, you know, desktop units that are kind of like the insides are customized. In like very interesting ways, but also like the outside casing is customized and people kind of dress in the way that they kind of dress their computers. And that, like, to me, that's like sort of a really interesting sort of phenomenon in terms of like the relationship between the human and the machine and like how they kind of relate to each other. And I was just thinking about it now in terms of like the fact that, you know, I understand that like gamers also like, you know, people still customize their computers and they still, you know, do all that stuff. But like on a sort of general level, you know, everyone kind of has the same similar looking smartphone and like most people have like similar looking laptops. And even if you buy a Windows laptop or whatever, like it will still like aesthetically not look that different from like a MacBook and stuff like that. The kind of like very uniform aesthetics that I think you allude to is, and you know, looking back on these photos, just being like, oh, like it wasn't always this way. Like people kind of like, you know, there was like a freedom to sort of this felt like there was like a freedom to customize things. It felt like there was like an encouragement to do so. And then as you sort of progress through those photos, you kind of go from, you know, you go from these like, you know, big desktop units to, you know, chunkier, but like kind of slimmer by comparison laptops to like the Dell computer screens and Dell computer systems that can kind of like connect to local areas. And like, you know, those things happening, you know, taking place in schools and stuff. I guess I'm looking at like how, you know, the sort of sense of uniformity kind of comes in. And it to me, I kind of wanted to know whether you had any thoughts on that progression. Like, do we, when it comes to like looking at the history of like LAN parties, and, you know, in the book, you sort of chart the kind of like the ascension, but also the demise. How much of that demise also comes with, as technology kind of becomes a lot more uniform and a lot more like, you know, put on production chains, the idea of being able to kind of customize your own kit becomes much more difficult to do. I don't know. Does that make any sense? Or
yeah, that absolutely makes sense. It's something I talk about a little bit in the book, this idea of there being a trade-off between convenience and control of technology. And I'm not the first person to advance that idea, but the basic concept is that the more convenience that we have accepted or that we have desired with personal technology, often the more control over it we lose. So one example of this that I talk about in the book is with games specifically. You know, it was kind of a pain in the ass to do LAN parties. Like, it was work. And a lot of people just didn't want to do it, which I can't honestly really blame them for, because you had to carry all this garbage to someone else's place, connect stuff. And there weren't exactly... Remember, this is like the late 90s, early 2000s. There weren't exactly like, you can't just go online and Google, how do I set up a LAN party? Like, you had to sort of have someone who knew or have some technical knowledge to be able to do this stuff. Today, if you want to play a game online, you open up Fortnite or you open up COD or whatever, and you boot it up, and it's a frictionless experience for the most part. And it is that way because so much of that experience is controlled and managed by the companies who produce the games. So Fortnite or Call of Duty or whatever, they're not even, you know, the servers are not local. They're not being hosted by someone running a server in their bedroom. They're owned by Epic or they're owned by Activision or whatever.
Yeah.
And those servers can be shut down. So we've seen this a lot in the last few years of companies launch online games and they don't do as well as they wanted, and they shut them down within like a year. And those games are just dead now. Like, they can't be played anymore unless fans set up their own private servers. And we've also seen this with purchasing games. So a lot of the time with licensed deals where a company has the right to produce a game based on some IP, when that deal expires, because we buy games through online marketplaces for the most part now instead of physical stores, it's really easy for a company to just take their games off Steam or off the Xbox store or whatever. And those games just don't exist anymore unless you already have a copy or there was a physical copy made. So, you know, that applies to computers, to phones, to basically any kind of personal technology. We've really tipped in the direction of wanting convenience, and it's a trade-off, right? Like, and on the one hand, accessibility and convenience is great because it means more people can use this stuff to improve their lives or to be entertained. On the other hand, it's we've ceded so much control over our digital experiences, right? Yeah. And that is something that I think people are also kind of waking up to at this point, because there are all these incidents, like I was saying, about products just being unceremoniously removed, books being just kind of deleted from the Kindle store, games being deleted from Steam. And people, I think, are realizing like, well, we actually used to have a lot more control over this stuff and it's been taken from us. So how can we kind of get that back? And that's a pretty complicated question.
Yeah. You've like covered and write and have written about gaming and also have worked in the sort of industry as well. And I wondered again, so because so much of this is sort of rooted around gaming, I don't game very much. And so I would not call myself a gamer for like many reasons, but I was interested in your perspective from that kind of position of how, I guess like to put it simply, What was gaming like in the sort of period of like LAN parties? What kind of games are sort of being played? And in your view, and you sort of touched upon this a book, but it'd be good to sort of like kind of get your broader thinking on this. How has like gaming culture changed in the periods like after the sort of LAN party? Because you mentioned in the book that like the thing that kind of really sort of causes decline as a type of social phenomena was in part to do with like console games kind of overshadowing. But also, I think you mentioned, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's also like as gaming sort of becomes more online, or sort of, you know, the sort of advancements of like wireless technology and like broadband technology kind of meant that the types of games that would work well in a LAN space, which would usually be in offline mode, become less of a priority. So I don't know whether I've got that right, but I wondered whether you could talk to us about LAN parties in the context of gaming and how it influenced the industry.
Yeah. So I think one reason why LAN parties became prominent was because the genre of game that was becoming more popular and PC gaming, at least, was changing. So in the 80s and 90s, I would say like the main kinds of computer games that were popular, and I'm painting with really broad strokes here, were like role-playing games, real-time strategy games, turn-based strategy games. And that starts to change in the 90s with the release of Doom. And you start seeing first-person shooters become a much bigger phenomenon. And first-person shooters kind of become the like the genre of the 2000s. And later, and kind of continuing on into the 2010s as well. And the thing about first-person shooters is that they require very low latency, right? Anyone who has ever played a game of Call of Duty or Fortnite or whatever online and had a bad connection to another person and seen them teleporting around the map or shot at someone and nothing happened, you know that you need a good connection, otherwise the game can't function properly. So that's one reason why LAN parties started to become popular, is because people wanted to play these games the way that they were intended to be played, and that often meant having to connect your computers directly rather than playing over the like a low-speed internet connection of the time. And you know, you talk about, you mentioned the Xbox and console gaming kind of disrupting this stuff, and I think really what it is in the book I mentioned the release of Halo 2, and that in 2004. I hope that's right. And basically, what happens with Halo 2 is it comes out for the original Xbox, and it's a sequel to one of the biggest games that had been released at that point. And it itself becomes a huge deal. And what it adds that the original didn't have is online play. And it works very differently from how online play had worked in the past. So with a lot of games prior to that, basically you would connect to a private server. So someone would be hosting one, and the quality of that server would depend on how robust it was, where it was located, all these things. With Halo 2, you are playing over Bungie's and Microsoft's online servers. And what that meant is that you have this matchmaking feature, right? So you have basically a party. So I could join up a party with my friend who maybe is in a different part of the world, and we can be paired with other players online. And there's a whole system for matchmaking based on rank. You carry your rank with you as you advance. And that is a very different kind of experience. And it gets into the stuff we were talking about control and convenience, because it becomes much easier to play an online game. Yeah. And you don't have to worry about finding the right server. It's all set up for you. And that, I think, is really the start of the decline of LAN parties, because it was much easier to do. A lot of that infrastructure was starting to fall into place where people had better connections. And companies were investing in building these servers that would let them host online games. So that, like with Xbox Live, I think is really where you start to see the decline of this stuff, because after that, this idea of playing games online becomes kind of normalized. And also, it's kind of ironic because around this time, gaming laptops are becoming more popular. So it would be a lot easier to go to a friend's house and bring that. But the allure of just being in your room and not having to go somewhere, I think, is pretty strong at the time. Yeah. So, yeah, that's really around like mid-2000s is where the things start to change. And obviously LAN parties go on longer than that and people are still doing them. But that to me is the real inflection point.
Yeah. I think also one really interesting thing that you mention in the book is about how the LAN parties are also kind of like the first, one of the first times that a kind of like broader meme culture sort of emerges. So I took this section. I just want to read this out. You say, this period also saw the birth of meme culture online. Early internet memes such as Mr. T ate my balls and all your base belong to us and elite speak spread through forums like Something Awful and Flash Portal such as Newgrounds, giving young internet users kind of a shared secret language. In the late 2000s, as social networks like Facebook gained traction among college students and more people got online, meme culture gradually became mass culture. I thought this was like a really interesting point. Like, and it was one that I hadn't really sort of considered, only in the sense that I think it was very easy. And I think it is still very easy to be like, oh, this stuff kind of like emerges on forums and it kind of just goes from platform to platform. But I wondered whether, you could talk about how like the sort of like what types of internet culture emerge out of LAN parties and like how would, especially considering, as you mentioned, like this is a much more sort of closed off version of the internet, at least like for now, like how does this kind of, how does this stuff kind of spread? And the fact that it does spread so quickly and the fact that we can sort of see a trajectory, like, you know, things like All Your Base Belong to Us, like having heard that in like a school in rural England, like, or in like suburban England in like, you know, the mid 2000s, coming from like a LAN party somewhere in the States, how does that happen? And like, what makes the LAN party, you know? Yeah, I guess, again, how does that happen?
Yeah, so I think one thing that happens at LAN parties in the 2000s is that, like I said before, people start doing file sharing, right?
And right, yeah.
This is obviously pre widespread infrastructure for that stuff. I mean, Napster and things like that are starting to kind of take off. But so one thing people are doing is they're not just playing games, right? They're saying like, hey, look at this really goofy thing, this funny thing I found on the internet. It's this guy from an old video game saying, all your base are belong to us. Isn't that wild? And things start to spread by word of mouth, right? Like online culture starts to spread through offline channels, just between people who are at these LAN parties. And you start to see, I think around this time, a gamer identity forming for better or worse, because people are forming culture around them by sharing memes like this, by sharing music, by sharing other things like imported anime clips or Japanese games that were never released in the US. So like anime also is starting to become a thing around this time too. And I think there's a lot of overlap between gamer and like LAN parties, culture, anime, nu metal, and a lot of trends like that that are now very mainstream. Nu metal, maybe not so much, but but anime and gaming are now very mainstream. And this is sort of one of the points where they started to spread, because people who would have seen this stuff early online are sharing it with their friends in these sorts of spaces. So that is one of the really early ways that this stuff gets around. And, you know, I think at this point, you know, people didn't even really use the word meme. Things were called internet fads, mainly like hamster dams and things like that. Like, oh, check out this internet fad. And they lasted for like 6 months or a year because there was so little to go around. The life cycle of this stuff was much longer. And yeah, I mean, when Facebook and MySpace and those platforms start to get bigger, things start to get shared through those, and it really accelerates the spread of this stuff. And obviously a lot of what we think of as meme culture comes from Something Awful and 4chan and these forums that in the years since have gotten not great reputations for various reasons. This was sort of the way that this stuff spread through offline channels before there was a way to share them on the mass internet. Because again, there was no, like, you can't go on Twitter in 2002 and post like, check out this meme. There's no way of doing that, right? Like, the most spread you can have is through offline channels of word of mouth, of people just saying, hey, there's this website where this guy says he's looking for his future girlfriend. Like, isn't this goofy?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's it's so interesting. I was also just thinking about how, in terms of like building, like, Because I guess like the LAN party, to sort of really put it in very crude, like sort of direct terms, is also like the first kind of very direct social media network or social network, right? In the sense that you are sort of all connecting together. And I wondered whether, because I was sort of thinking about file sharing as well as a sort of like kind of contemporary phenomenon within that. And I wondered whether like, you know, so thinking about like the sort of popular file sharing sites of like the mid 2000s, your Kazaa's, your like, Kazaa was the one that I used, but there are obviously lots of others, but it kind of like emerges from the same kind of like, you know, the same type of place. Is it the case for like the LAN parties are kind of like a precedent for what eventually sort of becomes file sharing, or do they sort of work in conjunction where these type like kind of LAN networks? So I think this is also a secondary question I wanted to ask you, which was like the difference between a LAN party and a sort of like LAN kind of network, which was kind of used, which could be used for like other sort of commercial reasons, or at least for other reasons that weren't to do with playing video games. You touched a bit on like the relationship between file sharing and LAN parties. I wonder whether, I wanted to know the difference between like what between the LAN party and like what other uses LAN had at that time in the context of like the broader internet.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the internet kind of comes out of people networking computers, right? And that's mainly happening on college campuses. Happening in government departments, especially Department of Defense projects. And college campuses are one of the main sites where this early use of networking is becoming really popular, especially for people who are working on computers. If they can share files, share information, communicate, access their stuff from around campus, it's incredibly useful. So some early networked projects like online, what we think of as online games today, but that were only accessible on a campus network, are coming out of colleges in the 80s and 90s. Things called MUDs, multi-user dungeons, which are like text-based multiplayer role-playing games, are coming out of colleges mainly. So there were a lot of uses for local area networks, and there still are. I mean, I remember when I was in college, we had what was basically like an intranet, where you could connect to other people and share files. And it was incredible, like the speeds that you could get files at compared to the internet access at the time. People were sharing movies and doing all kinds of piracy. And for a broke college student, that was really great. And it's become kind of less essential as internet speeds have become so much faster. And I don't think people, if they weren't around for the 90s or 2000s, realized just how slow 56K dial-up connections were.
Yeah.
But, streaming video was impossible. Even just downloading images sometimes would take forever. And it was a very, very different thing. So in that environment, being able to share files or to communicate with another computer user was a novelty, and you could really only do that through a LAN.
Yeah. One of the things that I found really interesting, and actually like, so kind of again another sort of like two-parter in this, was like I wanted to ask you about like the like how business and commerce kind of like engaged with LAN parties at all, because I sort of assumed initially going into it that like this was like a really obscure phenomenon, and like, you know, it wasn't something that was sort of being taken seriously by outside kind of commercial forces. But when I was sort of looking, doing some of my own research, I came across like a couple of places, including the Cyber Athlete Professional Network, which was seemingly was like the first, like kind of, you know, I'm thinking about like esports now and just how sort of like corporatized it all is, and kind of thinking like, you know, wondering whether like LAN parties were sort of, you know, a very kind of like an antithesis of it. But it does sort of seem like the idea of like doing competition of sort of like gaming as athletics, all that stuff, was sort of being entertained within this space. And I wondered whether, and also just like, you know, there were kind of tech companies who were sponsoring and kind of creating products for people to play like LAN games and stuff like that. I wondered whether you could talk a little bit about how kind of like the tech industry, but also like other commercial forces interacted with this phenomenon, and like the ways in which, like, did you sort of come across that in the course of doing your research, or like just by, you know, in terms of like what other people had been kind of submitting, or even just through like looking through photographs, how does that sort of professionalization of like LAN kind of Parsi's Land gaming look like?
Yeah. So, I mean, even back in the 90s and 2000s, there were these big multi-day LAN events, and a lot of those involved competitions. I mean, QuakeCon goes back decades at this point. There's a long tradition of LAN, massive LAN parties in Scandinavia and in other parts of Europe as well. Mm-hmm. And these are kind of different from the events that I focus on in the book, where mainly in the book we're talking about parties held at someone's house or at a local community center or something. But there are these other kinds of events that are huge, hundreds of or thousands of people all bringing their computers. And we do have some of those kinds of photos in the book, and you can see just the scale of these things is enormous. And those events are usually being sponsored by, graphics cards companies or gaming companies. Energy drinks are a big thing at the time too. So people think of today of like Mountain Dew as like the gamer drink. And there's also now all these like specifically gamer themed drinks too, like all these gamer themed energy drinks, because the energy drink market is so huge now. At the time, there was a drink called Balls, B-A-W-L-S, that was kind of the drink for LAN parties. And you can see these bottles in a lot of photos in the book. They're these very distinctive blue glass bottles with these kind of pebbled outsides. And I think that the company is still around, but they sponsored tons of LAN events. They had this huge Balls truck that would drive around with like a giant bottle on the back of it and park outside these big events. So there was corporate involvement at the time, but it wasn't exactly the same as it is today, right? Because the tech industry wasn't what it is today. So even when you have companies getting involved, a lot of the time they're being run by people who are relatively close in age to the participants of this stuff, who are probably people who are really into games, into messing around with computers themselves. And it's kind of before tech became this hungry, amorphous, finance-fueled industry trying to devour everything in its path, right? Obviously, it was still, there were still corporations, and it wasn't completely different from today, but I think there was more of a sense of like, these are people who are in this culture and who are growing alongside it rather than, oh, these are people who see this thing that is really becoming popular and want to monetize it or profit off of it in some way, which is really today, you see a lot of kind of what feel like cynical marketing grabs towards gaming and other kinds of pop culture. A lot of collaborations between just the strangest brands and products that they seemingly have nothing to do with. Yeah. And it's, so there is corporate involvement at the time. It feels different, though, to me from what I have read and from what you see in the book. And maybe it's just there's more naivety towards this stuff than there is today. We weren't as jaded about it.
Yeah.
But it does feel like a little more like, okay, this is a culture that is growing up alongside these people who were in the culture and have since started games companies or have done other things like that. And there's a lot more parity rather than the corporations sort of leeching off or parasitizing this community.
Yeah, and it does. Yeah, and I think you sort of summarized it really well, because I was trying to figure out like how to sort of describe kind of like a culture that is sort of built around like a particular kind of generation and where they sort of have a lot more control over like how that is expressed. Whereas like now it kind of, because I sort of think about, looking at sort of contemporary gaming culture, and I think you sort of make, you point out where like the sort of involvement of corporations, including corporations that it does not sort of make sense why they are sort of involved in it. Other than that, like this is kind of this is sort of an opportunity to make money. And so it kind of then does feel, it does sort of feel like almost the culture is kind of removed from that phenomenon. I wondered whether you could talk a little bit about the aesthetics of LAN, because like this is like what's sort of really striking. So I'm going through some of the photos, some of my favorite photos right now. And there's like, there's a lot of like Mountain Dew, references. There are the way that sort of people dress, the way that like, what particular headphones, like with microphones that are used, there's a lot of references to Japanese anime, on like screens or on like second screens. It's quite difficult to describe, actually. And it's strange because, like, having grown up in this time, I should be able to sort of describe it pretty well, like, considering I had, like, quite a lot of this equipment. And it does sort of say something about, like, how far removed, like, I am now. But, like, this thing that I am, I am familiar with, I cannot... Like, you know that thing, I hate using it as an example, but it's the one that comes directly to my mind, which is like, they say that, like, if you're having like a stroke, you know, you sort of see things and you can recognize that they're objects and they're familiar to you, but you have no idea how to describe what's going on.
Right.
And it all just feels like a bit amorphous and a bit fluid. And like looking at these photos and trying to describe them makes me sort of feel like that, not to sort of be a bit morbid about it. But I wondered whether you, as someone who like has spent a lot more time with these photos, can you kind of describe like what the aesthetic of like the LAN era looks like?
I mean, I think it's hard to describe because it's kind of chaotic.
Mm.
You see a bunch of different influences all mashing together in this way that is kind of unprecedented. Like you mentioned anime, which was, you know, today again is mainstream. In the 90s and 2000s, it was not cool. Like anime was like for weirdos and nerds.
And you'd have to boot like a lot of it, right? And
you'd have to boot like a lot of it, yeah.
That's another key thing. Like part of the reason why this becomes part of like a LAN culture, or like so like inherent to like the sort of like cyber culture of this time, is because in order to actually like be able to consume this product, you have to know where to get it from, and you have to know the person who can share it, or you have to at least sort of know people who you can get it from, right?
Right.
So there's a lot of right. like this stuff that is expressed, like there's hidden knowledge that I think is sort of expressed aesthetically through these kind of like through these images.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, anime at the time is mainly shared via fan subbed VHS tapes. I think, you know, you're starting to see things like Dragon Ball and Sailor Moon and Gundam on Cartoon Network and channels like that. And there was much more uptake of that earlier in Europe and in South America, but at least in the US and Canada, it was a little slower. And you see things like nu metal too. Like there's a lot of Korn and Slipknot t-shirts around this time. And nu metal at the time was a lot of people were into it. And then I think right after that, it went through this period of being like extremely, before we even really called things cringe, it was like, oh, nu metal is like very cringe. It's this like over earnest, at the same time, kind of posturing tough guy stuff. Mm. And it's only, I think, in the last couple of years that people have been like, oh, actually, no, some of this was kind of good. But it's that also ties into anime because you'd get like animated music videos of like a Dragon Ball character fighting with Linkin Park music playing in the background that people had made and shared before YouTube existed. So there's this mishmash of different influences. And I think part of the reason that's possible is because these people who are at these LAN parties are early adopters of the internet, right? So they're being exposed to influences that aren't yet in their mass culture. And that makes it really hard to describe, right? At the same time, I think there are recognizable patterns and trends. There are certain, you know, aesthetics, these shapes of headphones, like the back wraparound headphones that everyone I knew owned. Those show up in a bunch of these pictures. Are these certain like aesthetics that you start to see? But I think it's also interesting to compare these pictures to the image that a lot of people have of Y2K aesthetics, because to some extent that stuff is here, and to some extent it's you know, every retrospective look at decades or periods aesthetics are always kind of selective, right? And so I think these show that it was a little more diverse and weird, and also, you know, the people in a lot of these photos are not what you would necessarily call fashionable at the time.
Yeah.
they're not really into like the high fashion aesthetics of the era. They're mostly wearing like baggy t-shirts and snapbacks and stuff. But yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting as a corrective to that stuff too, just to look back and be like, oh, this is how a lot of normal people, non-celebrities, were actually dressing.
I also wondered whether you could talk a little bit about, so like one of the things in the photos is very, very obvious is like a lot of the people involved in this are like men. They're like white men,
but they like, you know, but they are sort of mostly male, and it can kind of come across as like a male phenomenon. There's like one photo I think that I recall where there are two women sort of sitting on, it's not clear whether they're sort of at a LAN party or anything, but it strikes me more as like on one of these computers, which is to sort of say that like this has kind of been coded as like a very male phenomenon, a very male experience. And I wondered whether there is like any reason for that. Like, was it like, does it sort of reflect the reality that like, yeah, this was something that it was largely like a hobby of, you know, a certain kind of male of a certain kind of age? Or is this something to do with like the culture of the time, which is one that obviously like kind of, you know, I've very generalizing terms looking back on that moment, but one where it is sort of assumed that like technology is something, or like, you know, computers and gaming are something that is very much something that boys do and not, or like that men do and not women.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's both. It's, you know, at the time, definitely girls weren't as encouraged to pursue this stuff, to pursue computers or interests in those kinds of things. Also, most games at the time and gaming culture, such as it was really, really targeted towards guys. And that is true still, but not nearly as much as it was back then. I think women were treated much more as a curiosity back in the 2000s in these sorts of spaces. And I mean, also there's the thing of like, if you were like the one girl in your friend group who played games or was into forums or things like that, and there were a lot of girls who were into that kind of thing, you probably didn't want to like go over to a house with like just like six guys and just hang out. But that said, there are a fair number of girls in these photos that are hanging out and just like playing games. And I felt like that was really important to show that it wasn't just guys. Like there were a lot of women and at the time girls. And, you know, I think that's important to correct this historical view, like this very like Whig view of tech history of, oh, things used to be very exclusive, but now they're better. Because yes, like things have gotten better in some sense, but there always were girls and women involved in gaming and tech and this kind of culture. And it's not like things are like amazing today either. Yeah. In some sense, things are worse because social media and mass culture have made it much easier on an unimaginable scale to harass women and minorities who are involved in this stuff. And also like, it's easier if you are someone who wouldn't be comfortable in that kind of space to go online today and play a game with strangers. Yeah. But the second you jump in voice chat or people realize that, you know, you're female or minority or whatever, you're going to hear some really horrible shit because people don't really see each other as human when they're communicating in that way. A lot of the time it's you're an avatar and a voice, so I can talk to you however I want. So I wanted to sort of balance that view of this sort of common sense view of, now more people are included. Like it's true. That's true. But they were always there and things aren't perfect today either.
No. Another aspect of it is also like one of the things I was really fascinated and curious by was like the types of things that people consume on their desks. There's a lot of like snacks and there's a lot of like, you know, Pepsi. There's a lot of Pepsi Cola. I was very surprised by how much Pepsi there was. And like, I think this sort of also contributes to the aesthetic of it. I think part of it, a long time ago, I was working on a story about esports and like I interviewed a dietitian who was working for one of the esports teams. And it was just like, it was quite incredible just like talking to this guy about how he was sort of developing a program that was supposed to like optimize your gaming. Right. It was supposed to optimize how long you could play, how like your endurance. And so the gamers that were on his team and he was based out in the UAE. So like was also being funded by like presumably like government funded to like create this team. But it was really interesting talking to him just on the basis that like he was talking about these gamers as sort of athletes and the idea that like, you know, there are now isotonic drinks that are being made specifically for gaming and electric. Like it's really bizarre. And I think about there are some vignettes in this book where they do reference like pro gamers, but they kind of, the pro gamer is almost sort of seen as like a bit of a deity, not as someone who like is an esports athlete, but like as someone who is so good at gaming that they can make money and they're almost like within this subculture. They're really, really high ranked. And I wondered whether you had any thoughts about that, especially as someone who has covered like esports and gaming before, about like what that kind of shift represents in terms of how game developers view like the work that they do, but also I guess like gaming as a culture, how much that has changed, and like what these voices and what these kind of like what these entries suggest about the way in which gaming used to be thought of and how gaming sort of is today.
So yeah, it's interesting you mentioned this idea of like pro gamers being seen as these kind of deities at the time. And I think that's true. There is a big difference between how people saw those sorts of figures in the past and how we do today. Today it's like kind of normalized that there are people whose job is playing video games on Twitch. And sometimes they are very good at it, but a lot of the time it's not necessarily that they're just very skilled. It's that they are good at working an audience, or they have other kinds of gimmicks that make people want to watch them. They're relatable, they're funny, all these kinds of things. And they're much more accessible and visible than they were in the past. Whereas in the era of LAN parties, this idea of like, wow, did you hear that this guy is so good at Quake that like that's his job now, is like playing Quake tournaments. It's like that's a mythic figure, right? It's someone that might as well not exist. Like none of you or your friends are going to ever be that. This idea that you would be making money by playing games was kind of outlandish. It was the domain of people like Billy Mitchell, who has since kind of been exposed as a massive cheater and fraud. I mean, I think it's just a reflection of how much smaller the economy and the community was back then. Games weren't the massive industry that they are today. It was a very different environment, right? Like there was still a relatively niche product and type of media. Whereas today, games are like one of the biggest entertainment products in the world. And people like, you know, the range of people who play games is immense. If you consider people who are like playing games on their phone while they're commuting, people who play Fortnite, Minecraft, all that stuff. It was very different back then, right? It was like there wasn't nearly as much money in it. And so it wasn't seen as like a potential career path unless you were going to try to make games or work on them in some way. And that was, I think, probably a relatively small number of people who were playing stuff back then. And so many of the differences between today and the past that we're talking about are just a reflection of there being less resources, and they're just kind of a materialist difference, right?
There's also like this other part where it's like, and I wondered whether like the economics of like doing LAN parties as well, in terms of just the fact that, you know, it seems, I don't know whether like accessible, because like I'm sort of in two minds about this when I was like looking through the photos. So on the one hand, it's like to set up a LAN party, you kind of need like some capital, right? You even need a computer, or you need like access to a computer. You need space if you're going to host one. You know, it makes sense why this would sort of be like often associated as like a suburban phenomenon, in the sense of like, right, well, you would need like a suburban space in order to do something like this. But at the same time, I guess it's like, well, if everyone is sort of getting computers, then like, actually, this is kind of like a bit more of a democratic way of socializing. There are like some really remarkably beautiful images. I think it's 192 and 193 I pointed out, but according to like at least the little booklet you've given me. And these are, I don't know what country it is in, but it sort of seems to be in, it seems to be like an African country of some kind. Mm-hmm. And like these are sort of repurposed modded computers that are kind of being kind of connected together in LAN. And it's not clear whether I think it is clear actually, like they are gaming. But I thought these were such remarkable images, because the image next to it is clearly of like a West, like in like a Western country, where the poses are almost exactly the same. The way in which they're looking at the computer is exactly the same. You can sort of see like this development of like a universal internet culture in like this kind of very like in your face, like aesthetic form. And I think it's so interesting looking back, because obviously like one of the things that we think about a lot on the show, but also critics of technology sort of think about, is this, you know, the uniformity of in, like the uniformity of like tech culture and how that emerges. So it's an interesting way of looking at how, like, you know, that type of, like, the type of way in which we physically interact with the machines has sort of been, you know, where that, the sort of earlier, like, adoptions of that. The second part I was going to, like, mention, though, was that I imagine that back in the 90s and the 2000s, the idea of doing something like this, where you spend, like, a very long period of time in front of a screen, you know, is something that is sort of seen to be, I don't, perhaps antisocial, but at least something that, like, a normie would not really do. And it's kind of interesting to look back now, because it's like, well, actually, so many of us, like, spend so much time in front of our screen. In fact, a lot more than you probably would do at a LAN party. Mm-hmm. and that kind of speaks to, like, a sort of broader cultural change as well, because so much of this is also about how, you know, in this period of time that you write about and that we're sort of looking at photos of, you know, what we were looking once at a subculture who were using, like, technology that was supposed to make kind of very simple things a little bit more efficient, and so you wouldn't have to spend so much time, like, doing all those things. The fact that they would be, like, you know, we would be seeing this as sort of like a kind of odd subculture, but now, like, they seem to have adopted patterns that are kind of so mainstream that in a lot of ways, you know, the things that they did, the things that the guys who sort of pioneered the LAN parties did, we now just sort of take for granted, or at least, like, that is very much built into the tech ecosystem that we are currently kind of involved in.
Yeah. No, it is funny to think, like, this idea of, at the time, certainly parents thinking, like, hey, you got to get off that computer, it's not healthy. Mm. Your eyes will turn square, is something that my mother said a lot to us growing up, is your eyes will turn square. And I think that gets back to something we were talking about earlier, which is, people who were in their teens around this period grew up having to defend what they were doing with computers, grew up having to defend games, the internet, messing around with the family computer, like, you're going to get a virus on there. Like, no, I'm just going online. I'm just talking to people. It's fine. I know what I'm doing. I know more than you. And today, I think a lot of us are looking at our boomer parents, and they are the ones who are glued to phones or social media, reading all kinds of stuff about, oh, did you see that President Biden is going to make it illegal to wear shoes? Like, and they're you know, experiencing this deluge of information that they just don't have, in many cases, the skills to navigate. Mm. So the dynamics have shifted a lot. And it is funny to look at these things and be like, none of these people were on a computer nearly as much as any of us are today. They didn't have phones. They couldn't be looking at their computers in bed. They turned their computer off at some point, which is kind of crazy to anyone with, like, a laptop who just closes it. And so the norms have shifted, right? What was seen as excessive or antisocial back then now is in many ways very normal. And that's, I think, one interesting thing about looking at these photos is you can see, like, oh, maybe we want to shift the norms again. Maybe we want to move back a little bit more in that direction. And I think a lot of people are doing that, are saying, like, you know what? I don't necessarily need a smartphone, or I don't necessarily need to be on social media all the time. And that isn't coming from, like, this, like, wishy-washy place of, like, wellness and, like, privilege necessarily. I think it's just coming from people being like, I need to claw back, like, my sense of self and my space from tech companies that have infiltrated every aspect of my life, and that is not tenable. And you know, not to be like a return person, but kind of return, you know.
I think it makes complete sense. I'm just conscious about time, so I wanted to, like, wrap up with a couple of, like, questions about kind of, like, how this project sort of, like, affected, or, like, what this project sort of made you think about, like, what the future, like, of gaming or, like, internet culture, like, might look like, which is to sort of say that, like, I've been thinking a little bit about how, you know, in one way, like, you know, there is still, as mentioned, like, in gaming, people are still building their own computers. They're still sort of, like, you know, building their own rigs and stuff. And it does sort of feel like a bit more specialized, but I do wonder whether, it becomes a little bit more friction between gamers and developers, especially as, like, things become a lot more, you know, pay for play, or, you know, that the barriers to sort of, like, being able to play a game become like a lot more costly. Whether we might see something like a LAN party of, or like something kind of akin to it in the future, or like by extension, I wonder whether as we sort of like come to grips with, well, you know, as people like want to sort of socialize, for example, but they have to integrate technology within that, like, can something of the ethos of the spirit of the LAN party be repurposed for modern day? Like, is there like, what can we learn from the people who kind of pioneered the LAN party and sort of like turned it into this cultural phenomenon that perhaps can make our own relationships, our own contemporary relationships with internet culture and, you know, in like technologies that allow us to access the internet a bit better?
I think people are stepping back a little bit from mass social media and from the centralized internet. So we've seen how easy it is for one person to take control of a platform that we completely took for granted and warp it to suit his own drug-fueled, chaotic ideas, right? And that is something that I think has woken up a lot of people about what the modern internet is really like. Or, you know, even things like Google just changing the rules about how ads work and just kind of screwing over a lot of sites in the process. Or the rampant implementation of AI, which is really just predictive text, into all kinds of sites and products that don't need it, and the ways that tech companies seem to be in this race to make as much joyful and interesting human work obsolete as possible, when we thought the future was going to be tech taking over the mundane, boring stuff and allowing us more time to play and to create. People seem to be wanting to create technology that does all that interesting, beautiful stuff. Mm. So I think a lot of people are reevaluating their relationship with all of this stuff right now. And my hope is that there will be a growth of more decentralized networks, of more localized networks where technology is used to facilitate human interaction across space or in the same space, rather than being used as an end to itself, with humans sort of being fed into it to keep it going. Mm. I don't know exactly what that will look like. I think some people are moving back to forums. I think platforms like Discord, which obviously has its own issues, those are becoming more popular as people realize, oh, I don't need all my stuff to be visible to literally everyone in the world. I can curate a little community with my friends. And that is, in a sense, much healthier and much much more realistic and closer to how humans are meant to, or biologically built to interact with one another. Mm-hmm. So I think for a lot of reasons, we are starting to see a shift. And that could look like a lot of different things. But for me, at least, looking at the book and looking at these photos and the process of working on the book has been kind of weirdly inspirational to think like, oh, this is something we can take some of these ideals and this ethos of having control over the tools that we bring into our lives and using them to enrich our lives and our relationships with other people rather than putting those relationships in the service of these tools. Mm.
I think it's probably a good place to end it. So Merritt, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you so much for writing the book. We will have a link to the book in our show notes if you would like to purchase it. But if people want to follow your work and just like catch up with what you're doing, how can they do that?
Yeah, I'm at Merritt K on Twitter, against my better judgment. I'm Merritt K9 on Instagram. And my website is otherstrangeness.com.
Great. Thank you for listening to this episode of 10,000 Posts. We really appreciate it. We have lots of good bonus content on our Patreon, $5 a month, and it helps us to do the show without ads and to stay editorially independent. We have a lot of good interviews, a lot of like good movie review. Like, you know, we watch a bunch of films on there. Also, if you subscribe to Patreon, you get access to our Discord community, which is, it's pretty cool. There's some stuff going on right there right now. There will be some stuff going on there soon. I am trying to learn how to use Discord, so please bear with me. It's a little bit tricky, but nevertheless, yeah, you can have access to our Discord and hear about like all the stuff we're doing and events that are coming up and stuff. This show is produced by Devon. You can follow them at Devon_on Earth, and you can listen to Kill James Bond if you don't already. And then finally, my co-host Phoebe could not be here, but you should subscribe to her Substack, phoebe.substack.com. There are lots of good essays there. I think she has one that came out recently. But in any case, yeah, support Phoebe by reading her very good Substack. Until next time, we'll catch you later. Have a good one. Bye.